Thank you, Kathy, and I want to thank Kathy and Sheila in particular for all the work they've done on this. And I don't know about you, but I thought Dolan and Senkler were pretty sharp today. And obviously the two Toms were typical, although he took a cheap shot at the Star and Tribune, I thought, when he said they buried that story on research. He actually is red now. He thought maybe he shouldn't have done that. I've got the distinct honor to introduce four of the, in our, well, my lifetime, some of you are a little younger, people who fundamentally impacted our state through their activities in public service. And each one of them, in their time, reached across the aisle, across regional differences in the state, and bipartisanly dealt with the challenge for their term in office. Let me first start with former Governor Wendell Anderson, who was elected in 59, fresh out of law school. He told me he met some of the new candidates this year and said it is in a private conversation, which I'm now going to make public, said that he was amazed at how much experience these candidates had, because when he got elected, he actually had no experience. He served in the House, and then in 63 was elected to the state Senate. As governor, I think most people are aware of this, he and legislative leaders developed the Minnesota Miracle at a time of their great challenge, rising property taxes and inequitable school funding. Does that sound familiar to anybody? He served as governor and prior to that was a silver medalist on the U.S. Olympic hockey team and also served in the U.S. Army. Secondly, Governor Al Quie, who began as a Minnesota senator in 1954, then went to the U.S. Congress in 58, served for 10 terms, as we all found out recently, was a very close friend of President Ford. He served on the President's Advisory Committee on Trade Negotiations, so his interest in his retirement on international issues is partially reflects that. He attended St. Olaf's and served as a pilot in the U.S. Navy. And in his term in office, I believe historically he had the largest deficit as a percent of the state budget of any governor in history. And he reached across the aisle. There were special sessions upon special sessions and resolved those issues at great political risk and did a heck of a job in the early 80s. I served under Governor Quie. That's how old I am. Third, Governor Arne Carlson started out as a Minneapolis City Council member in 65, served in the legislature from 71 to 79, state auditor from 79 to 891. Also worked bipartisanly, as some of us who worked in the education area during his term found even pugilistic Governor Carlson to be fairly easy to work with when you were working on business. In his time, he brought his, I think everybody recognizes, fiscal sanity to the state in terms of transparency of the budget and being honest with the citizens about how much money there was and how much needs to be socked away. And I think in history, he will be viewed as probably the most fiscally sound governor, other than obviously the previous two. Well, Anderson was known as Spendy Windy. Governor Carlson just retired as a business executive for RiverSource Funds. And then finally, Martin Szabo, Olaf Szabo, who served as Speaker of the House in the 1971, I believe, he was elected Speaker. He was elected at age 22 to the House of Representatives from South Minneapolis. He went to Congress in 78, served in both the minority and the majority, as he had in the State House, both the minority and the majority. And he was chair of the Budget Committee in 1992 when they balanced the federal budget for the first time in many, many generations. And he did that across the aisle. Martin Szabo, when I first got elected, I complained to him that I couldn't understand why the young legislators didn't get more responsibility because we were obviously more talented than the old timers. He smiled and he said, "The longer you're here, Larry, the more you will appreciate seniority." So his challenge was the federal deficit. And finally, the moderator is going to be Professor Jacobs, whose challenge was he had to sit next to me at dinner last night. And you know that he runs the Center for Study of Politics and Government here and has become, in his time in the last few years, a national spokesperson on all things political. I think they're done with their salads, and they're all going to join us. And I know the panel is supposed to be about the changing role of state legislatures. Knowing these three governors and former speaker, I think they're going to talk about whatever they want to talk about. Welcome.
My job is to immediately cede the floor to four of the most distinguished and accomplished public servants we have. The task that these gentlemen have and what we've asked them to talk about is the changes facing the state of Minnesota, the role of the legislature, and particularly, and in addition, the decisions they think the Minnesota legislature this year and the next year or so ought to be addressing. Why don't we start with Governor Anderson.
Let me just say this. I love politics. You may not realize it today, but the colleagues you have here, be they Republican or DFL, are going to be some of your closest friends forever. I met Martin Szabo in 1960. He's been one of my closest friends for 46 years. I met Al Quie about 35 years, a dear friend. I met Arne Carlson about 30 years ago, and he's been a good friend for nearly 3.5 years.
We're off to a good start.
I'll tell you one, if Arne will forgive me, but I used to have a wonderful sit-down dinner for legislators. It was catered by Town and Country. We'd have a social adjustment hour. That's where you drink. And one evening, Arne came and he said, "Governor, I'm between my many, many marriages. I brought my father." Well, his father, Swedish, born in Sweden. I had him sit next to me and I fussed over him and it was a wonderful time. Arne told me recently in 74, he's telling his dad he might run for statewide office. "Well, I hope you don't run against my dear friend Wendy." I'm done.
Governor Quay, do you want to add to that opening?
Well, I got to go on subject and tell you a story. When I was a young boy, my job was to go out and get the cattle to bring in for milking. And they would graze in the far end of the pasture, about three-quarters of a mile away. We had a good big cattle dog and a little terrier. So when we get out there and could see the cattle, it was a great cattle dog. He'd bring them on. And when a cow wouldn't do what he wanted, the dog would nip at the heels of the cow. The terrier then would get excited and nip at the heels of the cattle dog. And then when they get so bad that the cattle dog couldn't stand it anymore, he'd turn and he'd attack back at the terrier, and the cows would go out and do what they wanted to do. And it reminds me of a legislative body. And the ones in the majority, you know, they're the ones that have the responsibility to herd this whole thing along, and the ones who are the minority, and except for you new members, you all had experience in both ways probably, and then there's so much of the nipping at the heels of the ones who are trying to get the job done. So one of the parts of getting anything done is how you get along with each other. And this, and you noticed that part of the results of this last election was the fact that the legislature wasn't getting along and getting along with the governor, and people were talking about that a great deal. So I just want to talk about that subject first, and that is, the first thing you do is you talk with each other. And the second one is that you do something together that you both enjoy. Now, I've seen what happened already with that, with the coalition on early childhood education. Across the aisle, people talking together. Or we just about had a constitutional crisis in Congress over the appointment of federal judges. Across the aisle, people got together, started talking with each other. So that's important. But that is not enough. There's something also mystical that can happen. And it happens in every legislator's career. When something happened, you're able to accomplish something together. But let me go back to a study a long time ago called The Robber's Den by Dr. Sharif. And there they tried to understand that relationship with people, and it was easy to get people to be at odds with each other. Then they try having athletic games and everything like that, bring them together, and they couldn't. But one day the truck broke down to the camp where they were doing this, and everybody went to find out what happened to the truck, which had the food supplies. And to the amazement of those doing the research, people had come together. So then they said, well, let's do this again. So they break apart and then try all the normal ways. And then this time they broke the water pipe that came into it because it was sort of a desert area in Oklahoma. And again, that same thing happened, just like we saw at 9/11. Now, there are some things in this state that are as serious as 9/11. And one of them is education. Isn't it wonderful that we have a better education system than any other state of the union? 38% of our children in fourth grade read proficiently. Amazing that we aren't doing anything better than that. You have before you now the issues that are brought out there. Bear this in mind in education. The ones who have the most interest in the child, or should have, is the mother, the father, and the teacher. Those four, a child, a mother, a father, and a teacher. And every child hungers even to know their biological parents, even if they don't have them. Can we bear that in mind so that the system, through the third grade, involves the parents sufficiently so that the kids can achieve? And Ready for K, we talk about ready for kindergarten. Are they ready to begin the learning that occurs in the fourth grade? That is the greatest crime we're committing. Then we see in Minneapolis, kids who are a minority are seeking someplace other than the public school in order that they can achieve. So how do you do this as a legislator? The first thing you do is to go where the people are, not invite them to come in and testify to you. Because that's uncomfortable for them. Go where you aren't comfortable. Go to North Minneapolis. And secondly, when there are issues that divide you, and there are in the legislative body, do this. Do not invite one person from one side and then ask them a bunch of questions, and then later another person from the other side. Bring the two sides when there is absolute division and get them to testify together in front of you so they interact with each other, and then you can listen to them. It has a powerful impact in education. I just can imagine when a public school leader and EdWatch leader were together before you. There was a man who understood this, Adam Clayton Powell, who invited five of us, and we put that into practice. That's when they began, where the Republicans started working with Democrats in Congress on education matters. It began with that. So the means in which you can look at, like it had in the 9/11, the super ultimate goal, bring this city back to life again. And all of the issues in transportation, which is also a state responsibility, or health care, which is facing us with enormous cost. I believe that this body, not because of who was elected, but what was given as a pattern with a coalition across party lines, will bring us the answer for the future.
Thank you very much. Governor Carl.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to commend you and your leadership for putting together this program. It means a great deal. One of the speakers has already touched upon it, and that is trying to develop a chemistry as legislators, getting to know each other. And on that basis, it's much more easy to resolve differences of opinion. Now, we nationally are going through a period of what I refer to as happy talk, that we're going to have this big, massive national love-in. I pray to God it does not occur. We're really at our best when we have a healthy amount of tension, disagreement, and a real commitment to public policy. That's what a legislative session is about. Each of us had our problems with the legislature. And as years go on, we want to pretend it was one great honeymoon. Oh, it wasn't. Absolutely not. I have long pleaded with Wendell Anderson to offer my apologies for calling him so many different things during his reign. Because once you sit in the chair, you realize how unwarranted so many of the comments are. But that's all part of it. But I think what you're doing here today is, in a sense, starting to replace a function that was performed by the State Planning Agency. And I think the demise of that agency was one of the most unwise decisions made. Because thoughtful societies plan their future. As I look at this session and after meeting with the governor, I'm persuaded this is going to be a successful session. I think you're going to resolve your differences on financing higher and lower education. I think you're going to resolve your differences over a whole variety of issues ranging from environment, energy, etc. I think your one large contentious issue is going to be transportation. I think there's some very basic disagreements that will occur, and that may or may not be resolvable. But aside from that, there are some things coming down the pike that I think we're ill-prepared for. The first is the United States is a debt-ridden nation. We like to pat ourselves on the back year after year and say we're the wealthiest nation in the world. We probably are in terms of GDP. But we're also the nation that most heavily engages in debt, growing it at a rate of over $800 billion a year when you put it on the accrual system of accounting. And then we invent all sorts of ingenious ways to keep things off the budget. I love that. If a corporate entity did that, we'll be talking about the who's gal. But when our national government does it, that's pretty clever. That means that we're going to enter into periods of very scarce resources. And the time has come for the legislature and the governor to begin to work out some processes that to a large extent replace the role that the Citizens League in Minnesota once played and prayerfully will be able to come back and play again. And that's building partnerships with the community as a whole, the legislature, and the administration. There's no reason why you cannot create panels that include people other than legislators and start to plan. Start to plan on an era of scarce resources. During the Anderson administration, they put together a group, I believe it was known as CORE, and that was to review every function of state government, figure out how the delivery of services can be performed in a more efficient, non-duplicatory fashion. By and large, very successful. But if there's a bipartisan buy-in by both branches of government, the potential success is absolutely enormous, and it goes a long way to the restoration of trust with the relationship that you enjoy with your taxpayer. The second one that's coming down the pike, and there I would beseech you to use the resources of all of higher education, particularly the University of Minnesota, and that's the impact of global warming. And now the latest report indicates devastating climatic changes as early as this year. And it's easy for us to sit in Minnesota and say, well, the drought's over in Australia, or too bad Tennessee got clobbered, and what an unfortunate place good old Colorado is. But the reality is our time will come. And suppose we have a drought that was much worse than the one about 15 years ago. You're going to be besieged with all sorts of requests for air conditioning, etc. You have a whole system that's unprepared for climatic changes. You've already taken some very progressive research steps in terms of understanding energy alternatives, but that's still not reflected in our tax system. So a lot of work remains to be done on how do you go through the early stages of preparing global warming and ultimately trying to build partnerships with the national government, and you may even be successful in persuading the White House that it is a reality. You're a little slow catching on. The third is to start to take a look at your own processes. Start to take a look at your own budget. There's always been a quid pro quo, and I think we're just as guilty, I know I am, of going along so that the governor does not touch a legislative budget and the legislature, by and large, tries not to touch a governor's budget. Well, it's a quid pro quo that should be removed. The truth is the rise of partisan staff on a legislative level and a gubernatorial level inevitably results in more and more warfare and less reliance on individual research and understanding by legislators themselves. And the time has come to create a neutral resource staff, which was common 30, 40 years ago, young law students working their way through, performing research in a nonpartisan way, and keeping all the partisan activity in your personal relationship with your party campaign committee, etc. But it ought not to be inside the Capitol, and I would say the same thing for the governor's staff as well. Because if you start to realize that your most important function is quality public service and quality public policy, if that's what you set out to do, you will by and large succeed. But I have no doubt that the agenda that you have laid on the table for this session, I think it's going to be successful. I think it's going to be well met. I'm very concerned about some of the outside forces that will have an enormous impact. You're unprepared for hikes in interest rates, which are absolutely inevitable. You're unprepared for the sliding dollar, which is, I think, also absolutely inevitable. And it's going to impact us. We're not an island. We're not divorced from national trends. And there's limits onto what it is that you can do. but I would certainly request that that be done. But I would place emphasis on the process of engaging the private sector, I mean that in the broadest sense of the word, not just the financial, but the broadest sense of community participation, bringing in the natural leadership of the state, if you will, working with the political system, and starting to plan who we are, where we are, what kind of government do we want, how do we define our quality of life, etc. My last pitch relates to the University of Minnesota, and that is its governance system needs to be reviewed. I say that not in criticism. I say that because I love the university, and I want to make certain it has the best management system possible. You are in charge of selecting the board of directors. When people tell me who sit on the board of directors that their function is to support the president, right or wrong, I know something's amiss. The function of a board of directors is to represent the shareholders, which is the taxpayer of this state. And there's a natural leadership in this state. When I see the people like Wynn Wallen and Walter Mondale are not on the board of directors, not on the board of regents, then I say we're not picking our best and our brightest. And too often we see it as a reward and an entitlement for past service, as opposed to who is the most capable of filling the various skill sets that are necessary so that we can truly define excellence. Because global competition is a reality, and if the research and the strength of that research is not here and doesn't translate into jobs here, there will be no Medtronic tomorrow. It will be somewhere else. And we see the outsourcing and the impact that that has already. And the same thing goes with the search for presidents. The media loves everything to be open except their personnel affairs. It's true. Read the article about the sale of the Star Tribune, and it's so convoluted, I haven't got a clue who owns it. And nor do they. You're right. But my point is this. If you're going to compete with other state institutions, if you're going to compete with Harvard University and Caltech, etc., and they run around seeking excellence in a private way and get it, your hands are strapped behind your back when everything you do is public. Do you honestly think the capable person that you want is going to publicly throw his hat in the ring, jeopardize his current employment in order to seek an opportunity to be interviewed? No. Why is it that the process for selecting a football coach can be closed, but the process for selecting a president has to be wide open? No, what you want are end results. Bob Brunix will be retiring in the next several years. It's a given, and you've got to prepare the processes for replacement, and that is, how do you compete with the best and the brightest if you don't have the same processes available to you? Now, that's my pitch on a more private basis, but I do hope that we elevate that game, because the university is a large, large part of your economic future. And we need it. And when you see a decline in the research dollar, that means there's going to be a decline in our capacity to perform well in the future. And it's not just a case of money. It's a case of excellence and commitment to excellence and a willingness to define what that excellence means. Well, those are my brief thoughts. Not so brief. Thank you.
Congressman and former Minnesota Speaker, Marty Sabol.
Thank you, Larry, and good to be with all of you. Let me make some random comments. I haven't heard really anything I disagreed with so far. And Arnie, let me also second, I can't believe you repealed the Department of Planning. And I don't know when it happened. But Wendy and I were part of a panel yesterday that did a taping of the background of Minnesota Miracle in 71. All the essential work that was done at that point to get it done came out of the Department of Planning. And the creation of the Department of Housing, Later, all the work came out of the Department of Planning. They were the group looking forward. And I'm always reminded of Henry Ford. He had two theories. One, that people who worked for him should be able to buy his product. You know, we're getting away from that in our country. And the second was, he didn't want a planned society, but he wanted a planning society. And there is always a difference. I think the thought that somehow one devises the perfect plan is sort of scary. On the other hand, one wants the thinking process to go on. And that is absolutely crucial for state government. And I'm glad to see you're having this forum. Things don't change. We used to do that 30 years ago, and it was run by state planning. We also ran some retreats for members away, on the, not bicameral basis, but on the House side. We went up to St. John's a couple of times for a day and a half and let members visit. There was division. We were in the majority. Our caucus was for it. The Republican caucus was split 50-50. Half thought it was the greatest idea they'd heard of, and the other half wouldn't come. And the people who came, I think, found it very useful. Let me say, I spent 18 years in the legislature, 28 years in the Congress. I would not change a minute of the time I spent in the legislature for any of the time in Washington. Because what you do day in and day out, has it happens quickly. You handle a variety of subjects very quickly, and it has a tremendous impact on the lives of our people in many ways, much more on, except for the global issues of foreign policy, defense policy, and some of those things. But in the development of programs, your role is so much more important. And when you think of it, the states are really the center of our governmental system in this country, in both, I think, a theoretical and practical way. In a theoretical way, the federal government is a creature of the states. I suppose in reality, more states were created by the federal government than the states that originally created the federal government. But that's how the federal government came about, was because of agreement between 13 states to create it. But then you are also the focal point. You are also the creature or the creator of local government in this country, whether it's cities, counties, school districts. They're your creature. And one of the great strengths of this country is that 50 states do it differently. It's sort of interesting to be sort of away from Minnesota and watch other states. You know, you watch Washington, in our case, Maryland, Virginia, where county government is the total focus of their government. They have every school district is a county school district. We have, what is it, 350, I think, left today. Used to be 450. You know, you're structured very differently. But you're the ones who are ultimately responsible for how well local government functions in this state and in this country. Get along. And I agree with Arnie. What you need is vigorous debate and vigorous disagreement. But I always think that sometimes the biggest division in politics are not ideological, but whether the people who come with a sense of strong values are pragmatists who are willing to put their ideas to a test of accommodation and compromise. And the folks who are willing to do that are the ones who ultimately have the impact on how we govern ourselves. And just a couple of other sayings that I've heard over the years that I think are always useful to remember in public life. One was by Joe Donovan, who was Secretary of State for so many years. And one of Joe's sayings was, people are most certain about the things they know the least. And I've always found a great deal of truth to that, whether it's in a legislative body and or the public in general. And the other is one, I'm not sure who said it, but that maturity is the ability to live with ambiguity. And I think there's also a great deal of truth to that, because there is ambiguity of issues. Things are hardly absolutes. And and for the legislative leadership. I think that is always important to remember, and particularly for the members who are rank and file. One of the problems that leadership will have is the rank and file expect absolutes at times when the reality of leadership requires ambiguity. But it's good to be with you.
If I first might comment on the University of Minnesota, I'm a product of the University of Minnesota. Undergraduate, your graduate school, the military, law school. My tuition at the University of Minnesota was $27 a quarter. I know it was 1950, but $27 was not a lot of money. Any Minnesotan could get a university education then. Now the cost is awful. I don't know why it is that the generation that preceded us could make basically higher education tuition-free. $27, that's tuition-free. Now at the university, tuition, room and board is like $22,000, and this is at a public university. I know young people that are in their third year that have $50,000, $60,000 worth of debt. Now, how can anybody become a school teacher, a nurse, if they have debts of $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 that never pay it back? Something has to be done about tuition. Initially, you know, a great university was supposed to be tuition-free, and California was tuition-free not that long ago. Regarding the Board of Regents, you got a new system. Arnie, the reason that those great people you mentioned don't run for the Board of Regents is you've got a Regents Advisory Group. Okay? You go there. Your name is on the paper. You don't make it through. It's embarrassing. That's why they don't get involved. I'm the only person who served on the Board of Regents who went through the old process and the new process. The old process, I lived in the 6th District. I went around. There are more DFLers, fortunately, than Republicans, and I talked to the DFLers. They all agreed to support me. You caucused. I was elected to the Board of Regents. If I didn't get the support, I wouldn't have announced for it. Now it's all over with. My recollection is, well, the former CEO of Medtronic, a friend of mine, didn't pass muster. He's already contributed over $15 million to the University of Minnesota. But we can't get him on the Board of Regents. So let me, I grew up on the east side of St. Paul, product of public schools. There are 1,000 students at Johnson High School, grades 10, 11, and 12. No minorities. Not a single parent came from a single family, single parent home. Not a single person, student, owned a car. We did not have a playground or a pool. There's something else we didn't have. We didn't have crime. There might have been sin, but I wouldn't have known it. A year ago, October, I spoke at Harding High School in my old neighborhood. Sat down with the principal. She said, a third of our students are Asian, a third are black. Of the blacks, half born in the United States, half from Africa, East Africa, and then a mixture. Almost every single student there comes from a single-parent home. Almost everyone gets subsidized lunch. I gave my presentation. I'm walking out into the hall, and a fight breaks out. And what amazed me, no one was surprised. No one was excited, because it was so common. Now, two things. Over on the east side of St. Paul, in the old Johnson High School, is a remarkable facility that many of your people are aware of. They rehabbed my old Johnson High School into a K through 6 and room for 100 pre-kindergarten. And the school costs a little over $20 million, a combination of state, City of St. Paul, and private foundation. The classes are very small. They have babysitting for infants, for toddlers, et cetera, et cetera. When school ends, these young people, there's a YMCA $7 million attached physically to the grade school. So when they leave at 2 or 3 o'clock, they go into the YMCA. There's tutoring. There's babysitting. It's magnificent. You need one in North Minneapolis. You need one in South Minneapolis. And you need 10 in Detroit. It's wonderful. It should be a role model. It's amazing. My grandson is 7 and my granddaughter is 9. They go to public schools in the western suburbs. It's spectacular. 20 students to a class, not over 40 as it was at Harding. They magnificent physical plant. Last November, Orono passed a school bond issue, so they didn't have to lay off any teachers. It just breaks my heart to think that we're sending children to school, as Al pointed out. In Minnesota, my statistic tells me that 27% of all the people in our public schools in Minnesota, 27% in the third grade, are not reading well enough to put them on a track to go to high school. The national average is like 33. Well, that's scandalous. I mean, if you can't read, there's no hope. And we have to do something about getting people to read. I think there has to be an emphasis on pre-kindergarten, and you've got to do something about tuition. We ought to be able to at least do as well as our grandparents and our parents did for us. Thank you.
We're going to take some questions in a second, but I want to ask each of our distinguished panelists to react to the following question. I went back and I was reviewing press clippings over the last 4 decades just to get a feel for the kind of issues that are being discussed in the 60s and 70s. Well, you get the idea. A lot of similarity. Every one of these governors and leaders faced the challenge of constrained resources and a sense of enormous need. There were enormous conflicts, special sessions, fights of all different sorts, a full range. And I'm wondering, how is it that you resolve those conflicts? What would be the one or two things that you would suggest to legislators here on how you resolve the real conflicts and differences that exist?
I can just say this, that I thought one of the most useful things I did as governor, I invited every legislator and spouse to a wonderful sit-down dinner at the governor's residence, catered by Town and Country. We had a social adjustment hour, which is a cocktail party, and I invited the press, and I think I had 8 or 10 dinners because I wanted to keep it small, and I included, to say, the press and commissioners and so forth. Every couple that was there had their picture taken with my wife and I in front of the fire. Some of you remember a legislator by the name of Charlie Weaver. I went to his wife's funeral, and there's a picture of her, and I looked, and my arm was around her. They had saved the picture. I didn't want any legislator go back to Bagley or wherever, and what's the governor's residence like? I'd never been there. Tom Newman, a Republican from White Bear Lake, said, "Wendy, I've been to the governor's residence many times. First time I've ever been here to bring my wife and for a social function rather than work." I just think you have to have social contact with one another. See yourself as real people, people with children, problems, and the rest of it. And again, I understand that these people are going to be your friends for life.
On how you deal with you always have choices, and I don't know there's any magic formula on that, how you sort through the choices you have to make. But we tried always to be cautious if we were developing a new program, that was a program that didn't escalate rapidly in cost. If we were making adjustments in fiscal policy, that there were not automatic build-in and future costs. We tried to look forward beyond a year. We did not have budget committees. Those numbers were in the side pocket here. As Speaker, I spent more time on fiscal policy than anything else. We frankly tried to hide some money, keep it away from either the spenders or the tax cutters. One of our best friends was Walt Harvey in the Department of Education, who estimated school aids, and year in and year out, he would significantly overestimate the cost of school aids, and we never tried to correct that because they were considered to be inviolate while they were there. But on the other hand, we knew that that would help cover any problems we ran into. So, you know, let me react to what Arnie said about the fiscal place we find ourselves in the federal government. That is because in 2000 we had projected surpluses as far as you could see. And I've disagreed with President Bush's program, but frankly, let me be bipartisan about the 2000 presidential campaign on why we're in this problem of escalating foreign debt today. And that was because the presidential candidates on both sides used 10-year assumptions in the budget that showed projected surpluses growing. So they had programs that were phased in over 10 years. In Bush's case, it was primarily tax cuts phased in, the last of which wouldn't fully take place until he's out of office after two terms. On the other hand, if you'd gone back to the Democratic side, when Gore and Bradley were debating, and they had all their grand programs, some spending, some tax cuts, and you'd ask them how much of it will be implemented in the first 4 years, it would have been virtually none, because they were promising year 5 through 8. And there was one thing we knew for certain about those long-range projections. That was that they were wrong. What direction, we didn't know, but nobody had the capacity to do it. But the Congress came in, did the president's program that phased in things, you know, in the nature of the economy changed, 9/11 occurred, and all those old estimates disappeared. But we still kept on the same process of doing what the president had initially promised. That's what's dug the hole as deep and as difficult as it is for us for the future.
What I was faced with, as was in the introduction, a pretty severe budget shortfall. And here's the first thing I thought of. One is that you try and stay with your budget unless it is in the family, unless your daughter is seriously ill and you're willing to break the budget in order to save her life. There's some things that government does that are absolutely essential to people and they should continue. The second one is all the organizations and departments and all, and this is a local government as well, don't need to spend all the money they need to. And so I picked up a rule of thumb. You can cut 10% without hurting. And people in business said, you can do that 3 years later, you can cut 10% again, and you still increase productivity. So that was the next one. And the third one, then, is looking into the future so that you can increase in productivity. And so the head of MIT in Minnesota came to see me, and he talked about all the research the Minnesota the University of Minnesota does, and these two people are close to the University of Minnesota, have been talking on this. We ought to move it quicker from the research to where it actually is in productivity and people earn money from jobs from it. And so I figured I'm going to get the best person because he heads the biggest company and was 3M in Minnesota, and he wouldn't head that up for me. And so I got another idea, and that is I get two people who are at odds with each other. I got Dave Rowe, who was the head of the AFL-CIO, and Ray Plank, who I thought was the biggest labor baiter of anybody of my friends, the head of Apache Corporation. I asked them to be co-chairs, and it developed what they call the spirit of Minnesota Wellspring, which we talked about. Every piece of legislation that that group developed passed. It passed without any controversy between the political parties. So those are things you can do. Now I want to give you an admonition from within me. I watch what's been done when there's more money than you need from the past budget, and you get rebates back again. You know, I see nothing wrong with that if you're willing later to increase taxes because you don't have enough money. See, this is what I was faced with. I was a Republican, didn't want to ever increase taxes, but in order to save programs that are essential to people, I increased taxes, and it was necessary to do. So now I watch what you're talking about. You're trying to be a nanny to local governments and the universities. Yes, there's a feelings that Governor and look at all these Andersons we've got. Hey, Governor Anderson says, but don't save the university from themselves setting tuition. They made that decision. A long time ago, we decided to provide scholarships to students, and universities have to recoup that. And so they want the scholarships, the federal scholarships, to come, and then they recoup it. So you can't go back to the $27 tuition. And the second part of it is, don't try and bail out local governments. I agree with Coleman, Mayor Coleman. You're going to put a lid on property taxes or give a rebate for 15%, as some people have suggested? Listen, work on things that are important for the future, that will develop in the future, rather than the Band-Aid in order to do two things, that I'll be saying this. It may have a temporary help, but mostly, to me, is playing politics so you'll look good in the next election.
Larry, what was the question? Was it the serious? Yeah.
You partly addressed it, but the how you reconcile budgetary constraints, an enormous need, and how you reconcile the conflict over that choice, that pressure point between lots needs to be done, there's just not enough money, differences exist. How do you manage that so you don't have a government shutdown, you don't have the train wreck?
Anytime you have a budget shortfall, it's an extraordinarily painful process. I think as time goes on, our memories tend to dim of how difficult it was. I recall quite well in July of my first year, perfectly unwilling to leave the residence for fear that somebody would mob me. When your poll ratings go down to the low 30s, you begin to understand that life is very difficult. Going to my first governor's meeting, all governors were getting battered. That was very comforting to me. And then I ran into the governor of Rhode Island, who on the day he put his hand on the Bible to take the oath of the office, the credit unions collapsed in Rhode Island. And he had to shut them down so people couldn't get their money out. By the time the governors met, sometime in June, July, his popularity rating was down to 9%. At that point, you question whether your own family is loyal. And legislators, being what they are, think nothing of creating an incredible fiscal mess and then pointing the finger at the governor and saying, you wanted to be governor, so solve it. And no matter what you do, the governor's wrong. Well, part of that is reality of life. But there are some professional things we should really start to take a look at. Because as Martin Szabo said, and I learned a lot, frankly, from Marty, one, I like it when governors bring the budget into the bosom of their office. It's the heart and soul of any administration. It sets your priorities. It tells you everything you want to know about today, tomorrow, etc. And what we've had in recent years is a fundamental disrespect for the finances of the state as we politicize that piece of the system. That was one piece that had not been politicized before. The second thing is the diminishing professionalism of the people who handle the budgets, both on the House, the Senate, and the executive side. By the time I was in my final year, we had just gotten back the AAA bond rating. We had lost so much competency to the private sector that we literally limped home. Now, we as a state have to realize that whatever talent we have in vital areas, other institutions are going to compete for that talent. And when you get young, talented people coming into the Department of Finance or into a legislative appropriation process or whatever, and they begin to learn the system, as they learn, they also increase their value to the private sector. And many, feeling constrained by governmental salaries, go to the private sector. And that loss is enormous to government. I would respect, again, the study group approach, and that is, how can we retain, along with developing, or even getting people with considerable talent to serve on the House, Senate appropriations staff, keep them out of the political side, and likewise in the Department of Finance. You know, when you think about your budget, roughly, what is it, $32 billion? Reserves of what, $700-800 million, is that about right? Well, your reserves, first of all, you know, Kudrowski commented on it a couple of days ago. It was a very thoughtful article. How do you smooth out the revenue system? Well, that's the dream of every government. One is, I would be leery of having it too smooth. You need a little pressure within the process itself. But when you, the dream has always been, particularly from the academic, has been extend the sales tax and then give rebates to lower income people. The truth of the matter is, as anybody knows anything about the tax credit system, once you involve a rebate process, paperwork, etc., the lower income groups by and large do not participate. And so that tax becomes an inordinate burden on those who can least afford to pay it, and you, what you're doing is you're taxing the fundamental essentials of life, food and clothing. It is not likely to be workable. But the system that is more workable is to have a stronger system of reserves. And that's where you have to constrain your appetite for spending. Your reserves at a bare minimum should be 5% of the totality of your budget on a possibly reducing basis. But as Martin said, they hid money. Well, frankly, any good administration does precisely the same thing. And that's what you ought to do, is to keep your reserves very, very adequate so, in fact, you are planning for a decline in revenue. But the fundamental basis is having a deep respect for the finances of a state, a meaningful respect. And that is, we will not spend money that we do not have. We will project at a minimum 4 years out. And that will give you the totality of cost. And if you're going to put inflation on the revenue side of the books, you put it in on the spending side. Finally, because I think this was in part the gist of the good professor's question, and that is this camaraderie, how do we get along, et cetera.
How do you resolve conflict?
Yeah, well, I thank you for your interpretation. I think you're very fortunate. You know, the most bogus thing in politics to say today is to say, well, extremism has crept into the system, both sides are guilty, blah, 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 blah. It was a food fight. I frankly think this country bought into the politics of Karl Rove. And I think it's one of the ugliest chapters of our history, of basically taking man against man and saying one is more significant than the other. And that divisiveness truly built fundamental distrust. I pray that period is over. Today, that is part of Republican chapter. But believe me, Democrats have had their past, too. But what should be learned from that is that in this session, and prayerfully in future sessions, these so-called social issues are off the table. And the focus is on the bread and butter. How do we provide the needs on a daily basis today? How do we define the role of government? How do we define the expectation of our service? And how do we effectively and thoughtfully and courageously plan for our future so that we're not surprised by it?
Thank you. We have a few minutes for questions. Those of you who have questions, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Yeah, let's get a mic over there. Up. Yeah, we do. Ellen's running over there with a mic. It's coming. She's a good sprinter. Here we go.
Question I guess one. This is not so much a question, but to say that I'm a representative of Northside, very proud of it. And I just want to give thanks to the folks, the governors, I should say, excuse me, of speaking on behalf of Northside. I think that our educational system has fallen apart. Excuse me, I'm not used to speaking on this type of arena. My first term, and I'll get better, governors. But I just want to say that thank you for the opportunity that you have expressed about the north side of Minneapolis, because we are falling apart on our education. And the other thing, I just want to give congratulations to our 5th District Congressman, Martin Sable, who has helped the educational system grow on the north side of Minneapolis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think I saw Phil's con over here. Whoops. Okay.
I guess I'll do mine and then hand it off to Phyllis. I'm curious as to if you could each quickly chime in about our most urgent infrastructure needs in Minnesota. And obviously the first one that comes to mind in transportation is transportation. So I'd ask you to give two thoughts. One is specifically in transportation, and then second in an area other than our transportation system. Thanks.
Well, I thought the legislature a couple of years ago acted very responsibly. You had a Republican in the Senate that offered a tax increase bill. A House, excuse me. But the legislature got together and passed, I thought, a terrific transportation bill. It was vetoed by the governor. Do it again. I think you have enough strength now to override a veto. I think all of the governors here, I mean, we always believed in transportation. We always passed a good transportation bill. When the price of gasoline goes up, you've got to put more money into transportation, not less. You're sitting out on 394 going 5 miles an hour. You're polluting the air. It's costing you money. I mean, we need public transportation. We need roads. We need bridges. And that used to be a bipartisan issue, and I don't know why it hasn't stayed that way.
I think transportation is important, but I frankly think one of the most important education issues is the development of low-income family housing in a dispersed fashion in urban areas. I think that, frankly, is more important than lots of the funding directly to education. And I said yesterday that one of the disappointments I had of everything we did in the 70s was that we eliminated the fiscal reasons for concentrating low-income families in certain geographic areas. And for some reason, from the 80s on, we've had increasing concentration of low-income families in some in the center cities and increasingly in some suburban areas. And I think it's just an absolutely crucial issue for you to deal with if you want to deal with the fundamentals particularly elementary education in our state.
Let me add on to one word that Martin Sable said, dispersed. To me, that's essential in housing. You don't locate them all, the poor folks over here and all the other people here. That's the way our housing has been moved. Now, each of you may be called on, because this is controversial. And I recall when I was running for governor, was in Congress, and in South St. Paul, there was a low-income housing unit being set up in a place where there aren't low-income housing. Now, the easiest thing for me, because I wanted to be governor, was just not ruffle any feathers. But I knew I had to stand up for the people who need it. So I gave my support to that housing. You know, I had no direct impact to it. So you have a prestige in your community to hold up to a more noble position than a lot of times we revert to. But I want to go to the transportation, because that's the infrastructure the most important. And yes, taxes are important. Yes, if the 10% increase in the gas tax to come before me as a governor, because I went through tax increases, so it's easier to say that, and I'm not in office anymore, but I would not have vetoed that. I would not have gone through. But there's something more important, and that is what is out into the future. But the people of the state need the vision of where we're going. Because it's pretty well accepted we're going to have 1 million more people here. How are we going to transport them? Is it the old way? Can we get enough lanes on our highways? Or will we build on what we saw, which people, including myself, did not agree with when it started, the Hiawatha Line, and now we see it's successful? Can you get rid of your pride and say, let's look at a way of some better transport system and look in the vision, get to St. Cloud, get to Rochester, get to Mankato, as well as building the network between.
Martin Szabo was the one who really started light rail in Minnesota. And I was governor at that time, and when I saw the appropriation for matching it, it really caused an enormous internal debate inside the administration. One was a tremendous fear on ridership. The name of the game traditionally, as we saw mass transit, was it's good for my neighbor but not good for me, and so we'll stay in the car. And that, by and large, has proven to be true. The second part of our concerns had to do with who's going to pay for the deficit. And at that time, we were flush with money, and I knew full well that the counties, who all wanted something, also wanted us to pay the bill. And when you start to take on that kind of a burden, it's inevitable that you're going to have some deficit problems in the out years. What's remarkable about light rail is how all of those fears vanished almost immediately. It was an incredible success, absolutely astounding. And I would certainly urge the legislature to give some very serious thought to a 20-year plan, where every year or every other year you spin out another line. But get back also to what Governor Cui is saying. You know, it's like Alice in Wonderland. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. You got a plan. What's it going to be like? Right now, you're going through the first phase of what will be a continuing policy, and that is the reduction of air travel to the greater parts of Minnesota and a whole variety of other states that have rural areas. It is not a profit center. Who's going to pick up transportation to Brainerd, Bemidji, Moorhead, etc.? Rail has tremendous potential, because right now the rurals tend to see it one way, the metros tend to see it one way. The truth of the matter is what binds them together is far, far greater than any division. And any kind of a 20-year plan implementing both a tax increase, which I would support, and a bonding increase, which I would also support, brings together both, so both can go back to their districts and say, "What, you know what, we've covered greater Minnesota and also the greater metropolitan area, and we did it in an agreed-upon fashion." That's precisely how paving got done in the city of Minneapolis. Everybody wants the first project in their district. Somebody's got to be last. But once you agree upon the totality of the plan, then it's much more easy to parcel out who gets what when. But it has to be part of a rational order. The reason I mention this is because the alternative is so potentially devastating from an environmental perspective, but also from the perspective of the amount of time and frustration that people have on our current clogged system. So I really and truly wish you the best in that.
I want to thank you all for coming, and also want to apologize for false calm. We didn't get your question. I want to thank our four very distinguished panelists. We are 10 minutes behind. There's an interactive session over in the main atrium, the Humphrey Institute. The next session starts at 2:15. Which is in 8 minutes. So thank you very much.
That's what I said.